Hello and welcome to the very first episode of Mana. Today we have a special guest, professor of formal philosophy, logician, and the founder of Bubble and Information Studies, or it's Information and Bubble Studies, and the former leader of that center. Vincent F. Hendricks, thank you for coming here.
Thanks for having me.
Today we're going to have a very meta, I might say, episode where we're going to talk about consciousness, and it's going to be called Mind, Memes, and Markets. This is something you know very much about as somebody who, I remember actually as an anecdote, you were the first modern philosopher I actually encountered. It was at the technical high school where at the height of Trump election 2017, and a technology course, they showed you when it came to the bubbles and the info storm that happened at that election.
I'm delighted.
Yeah, so you were the very first modern philosopher I actually encountered in my life. And ever since
correction, no, I'm not a philosopher. I'm a professor of formal philosophy.
You're a professor because you believe that philosophy is something that every human should strive for?
Yeah. Given the assumption that philosophy basically means love of knowledge or love of wisdom, I suppose we all are, right? And so surely philosophy is a field.
Yes.
But I should also take that every single human being on planet Earth is interested in knowledge. So from that perspective, we're all philosophers. Then there are the ones who are educated in philosophy and neighboring disciplines. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those. Mm-hmm. So I'm a professor of formal philosophy, and I do philosophy, but I wouldn't call myself a philosopher. It strikes me as very, very pompous. Uh-huh. Suppose you're at a dinner, right, and people ask you what you do, and you ask people what they do, and, well, I work for Novo, and I have a hot dog stand, and all of a sudden you come up, I'm a philosopher.
Yeah.
Like, come on. So just professor of formal philosophy is good enough, and Vincent is even better.
Okay. Would you then say that you're maybe on a journey, on a philosophical quest in your life?
Well, I try to practice what I should call something like, unbiased curiosity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a non-preconceived kind of curiosity. Mm-hmm. So I suppose I try to take my biases and put them away and my preconceived ideas. And then I ask questions to the world. And then I hope I can formulate a question that the world is willing to answer. Mm-hmm. And so that's what most scientists do. I don't think there's much difference between philosophy and a lot of other disciplines, but some people tend to disagree. But to me, philosophy is just a mode of inquiry. Mm-hmm. And you have a certain toolbox for that. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm basically a theoretical computer scientist by training, or as you say, a logician. Mm-hmm. So what I carry with me all the time is a set of tools, mm-hmm. My logical toolbox and my logical mode of analysis. And I try to look at that, the problems that I'm interested in, societal problems, cultural problems, whatever problems they are, through that lens, through my prism of my toolbox. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I use the toolbox is because logic, or the language of mathematics, mm-hmm. is a good skeleton,
yeah.
If you wish. It's a good system in which there are a lot of cubby holes that you can put different part of the problem into, which is then better understood, and then you try to connect them. So the way I approach my field is think of it as a web, mm-hmm. That I have that I put over a new problem, and I go, I know that node there, and I know that vertex there, but I don't know that node vertex there, but if I take, or that node there, but if I take that vertex and put it, so the way I look at problems is basically through my web or my net, mm-hmm. and then I use this net to analyze all the bits and pieces and nuts and bolts, the ones I understand and do not understand, the ones who I can say, okay, I put that in a cubbyhole, that's well understood, whereas this connection here is less understood, so I might have to use some logical tools to make that connection.
Interesting. How creative would you say that endeavor is?
It's a funny question that you mentioned it. My new book, The Bare Necessities, as it would be translated to into English, but in Danish it's a different title. Mm-hmm. I actually discuss that towards the end of the book. Because once you have this skeleton in place, then you can be creative in putting the pieces together. Mm-hmm. But it's always regimented by your language,
yeah.
right? And it's always regimented by the way in which your tools will operate on the problems that have to be pretty well defined. Mm-hmm. So you can be creative in when you do proofs or when you, say, shorten definitions or you put in a limiter that you will use, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a certain, and proofs can be more or less elegant. Demonstrations can be more or less elegant.
Yeah.
Some of them are cumbersome, and you, the more you understand the way of the proof, the more you can shorten it and make it more elegant, et cetera. So there is an amount of, what I should say, creativity in that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like music, for instance. Mm-hmm. I discussed that by the end of the book, where to me, music is... and I think some musicians, well, I interviewed some musicians for the book, Chris Mindoki among one of them, where, yes, there is a lot more freedom there, right? Because mm-hmm. you can go move on octave up, one octave down, you
yeah.
can switch the tempo, you can... So I go, when does a musician know when they get it right?
Mm.
Because there are so many possibilities that you could work from. And then Chris Mindoki has actually a very good... allegory for that, and we maybe can talk about that later, where he goes, well, it's like any other field. Uh-huh. It's about practice,
uh-huh.
right?
Uh-huh.
You have to practice your bass, you have to practice your, if you're a composer, you have to practice your nodes, you have to. So it's like, to me, most of what we do endeavors in life is 10% talent and the rest is just hard work, and that's just the way it is.
Mm.
And the same goes for Charlie Bird Parker, the famous jazz player
yeah.
said once that here's how you do. You practice and you practice and you practice and you practice. And when you get up on the bandstand, you forget all what you have learned and then you basically just wail.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But you can only wail in a qualified manner since you have been practicing for so long.
True.
Precisely.
Mm.
And that goes for every field.
Okay. But when it comes to specifically...
Goes for you too when you're doing this interview. You
know? Yeah, of course. So the more practice, the more...
It gets.
And then maybe we are more on the intuition side because it's just built inside of me now because I've practiced it so much. So we can say luck meets preparation.
Well, you internalize it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the way I look at the brain in many ways is... that it's a computer that runs a lot of different scripts.
Mm.
So a good example would be, remember when you had to learn how to bike on a two-wheeler?
Yeah.
Right. So three-wheeler was pretty interesting because it was uninteresting because the balance was kept by three wheels.
Yeah.
But once you elevated to two, it became a little more problem. It became somewhat more of a problem.
Yeah.
So the way I was taught how to bike on a two-wheeler was that my mother took this broomstick and stuck it down by the end of the bike. And then she goes, pedal those pedals. And I said, okay. And so I did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then she started running. And all of a sudden, I go, okay, so in order for me to move forward, I have to pedal these things.
Uh-huh.
Good. So, and if I stop pedaling, then I will fall over because inertia will tell me that I have no energy, so I can't. Right. And then all of a sudden, the brain understands, okay, in order for you to go forward on a bicycle and while you keep your balance, mm-hmm. you have to do the pedals.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a steering wheel, too. So if you turn it to the left, it will go left and right. And then it has, so, but if you do that without also pedaling the pedals, chances are you will fall too, if you don't have enough speed. And so the brain has to first work this script about pedaling and balance. And then it has to work about the script about the steering wheel. And then once it's understood the thing about the pedals, it'll put that in the automated processing unit and we'll just run that script.
Yeah.
And then it'll start another script up.
Yeah.
And then eventually you know how to bike. Mm-hmm. And once you're done with that, you have to worry about signs, other bikers, traffic, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So the brain has to be taught running a lot of different scripts. And once it understands these scripts and knows how to execute them, then basically what it does, it puts it back in internal, in automatic processing, because then there's more bandwidth for the problems that it needs, what Kahneman and Tversky, or Kahneman calls system two processes, which are much more cumbersome and we have to think about things.
Mm.
So the brain is basically one big economist that way, that it tried to run, in order for it to be able to run a lot of scripts, it has to practice on the scripts, and the more it practices, the better it becomes.
Mm.
And that's, of course, also why AI is a little dangerous for us,
because
it doesn't ask us to practice in order for us to be able to run the scripts. And if you haven't practiced, we can't know whether or not it's the right or the wrong script. And so you can't really know whether your answer from ChatGPT is right or wrong unless you had practiced before.
Yeah.
So it's a tool like other tools. So what I'm trying to say is that in many ways you could think of practice as a precondition for processing a lot of different kind of scripts and to also get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So when you sit here and do this interview and correct me if I'm wrong, then basically you have sort of an overall idea where you want to go with this. You have already sort of got yourself an outline of it. You might not have all the details because it always has to be a little spontaneous, so you don't have all the details, but you know where you're going.
Yeah.
So you have, again, you have your web. Right?
A skeleton.
You have a skeleton already, and then you're going to connect the dots.
Nice.
And the more you practice it, the better it becomes, right?
Of course.
Like any other field.
I remember when I had the mentalization course at the Copenhagen University, they even spoke about automation and the manual as two dichotomies. When it's automated, it's just a process that just goes on almost in the background. It
executes your script, right?
Exactly.
There are certain times, maybe the listeners can may have experienced this as well. There are some times where I sort of have the feeling that I can feel my brain processing, and usually if I take the car late at night and I'm running on a highway, or well, any road, but basically a highway at high speeds, I know that if I at 120 kilometers an hour crash into something, that's kind of the gameplay, right?
Yeah,
and my brain knows that as well. So the brain is making everything it possibly can not to make that happen. And the way it does that is that it gets so many impressions, right? So there's me going forward, there are cars coming in the other direction, right? You have the stripes on the road, you have your reflections, et cetera, et cetera. And then it has to adjust the speed with whatever traffic is around, and you have to make sure that if there's a car coming on the outside, you want to pass, then you've got to slow down a little bit. Oh, there you can sort of feel the brain processing. It just goes. It runs all these scripts simultaneously, right? Looking at the reflectors on the right side of the highway, on the shoulder, while it has the stripes right there. It has the speed up, down, geared up, gear up, etc., etc. So you can sort of I have this illusion or impression at least that I can feel my brain processing in order to survive.
Interesting. On this note, on the brain, do you think that these are all survival kits that the brains that they are actually programmed to help us to survive? We can maybe look at it from an evolutionary psychology perspective or biology perspective. What are these impressions or expressions a symptom of?
As far as, there are a lot of different, I'm not a philosopher of consciousness, and that's a whole field in and by itself, and I'm not a cognitive psychologist either, nor a
cognitive scientist.
Cognitive sciences as such. But one of the things that seems to be pretty robust about our consciousness is that we have more than one layer of it. So we are sitting here, and I'm aware of that. We are having this conversation. But I'm also aware of the fact that we are having this conversation. Yeah. I might even be aware that I'm aware that we're having this conversation.
You're going to find the memes very interesting, the ones I'm going to show you on that.
Okay. So good point.
Yeah.
And so we have first order consciousness.
Yes.
Second order consciousness. And we probably also higher order consciousness. Not only do I think, but I can think about that I think. Not only do I believe, but I could believe that I believe, or I can know that I believe, etc. So we have more layers to our consciousness than just one. And that's extremely potent because it means not only do I think, but I can also think about whether or not the way I think is right or wrong, correct or incorrect, right or wrong as to moral, right, correct or incorrect in terms of logic or epistemology or whatever it will
is
be.
That a metacognition practice?
It's sort of a metacognitive level, right? So not only do I think, but I can think about the fact that I do. And that is by far one of the survival traits that we have been living on and profited from.
It's
during the evolution for sure.
It's exclusive to human beings.
Well, you have to ask a biologist about that. Ask my good friend Johan Olsen about it. He would know.
We might get him here for the next episode.
He's magnificent. He's a good friend and very, very. He's probably the only rock musician who also ever published in Nature, by the way.
Okay, that's very paradoxical
makes it very unique. Anyway, so at least we have it as humans. I suppose that there will be other species that might have something equivalent to it. So suppose certain whales might have it, dolphins, who knows? I don't know. But at least it's pretty prevalent with humanity, and it does us a lot of good because we can rectify our thinking while we're doing it. So we're not only doing one track; we're doing at least two tracks, maybe even three or four tracks at the same time. And so that is definitely something that evolutionary have taken us to this point. Uh-huh. Right now, I'm sorry to say, it seems like everybody is running first order consciousness, but that's because of the social media.
Uh-huh. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm being a little polemical about it here. But you have to understand that since we are able to reflect upon the fact that we reflect, mm-hmm. it also means something for our autonomy. Right, mm-hmm. understanding of being about being humans who can make our own choices, mm-hmm. That it could set our preference relations and all the other things that stems from the fact that we can think about the fact that we're thinking, mm-hmm. And that is part of being an autonomous agent, mm-hmm. yeah, as being a human like mm-hmm. an autonomous agent, mm-hmm. and autonomy is a very good thing for humans to have. However, it would be a lot easier if we just marched along, everybody, the same direction.
Yeah.
And if you ask me, autonomy is a friction for people to all march, right? Because you might go, I don't approve of going left here, although because everybody else is doing it, mm-hmm. that might be the wrong direction to walk, right? And so I'm going to go right instead of left.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you break the chain. Uh-huh. But if you want to sell a lot of products of a particular kind, you don't want too many outliers like you who are going to make their own decisions.
Autonomy is a
great friction
for
people if you want to control people. Mm. And as Mark Zuckerberg said when he started the metaverse, being on the metaverse should be the most frictionless experience ever, which basically means don't think about it. And so they're not particularly interested in autonomy because autonomy is not that good for their business model. Mm. They're not interested in democracy either, which is sort of collective autonomy over a lot of agents. And as Mark Zuckerberg has been saying, safeguarding democracy, that's above my pay grade. Just to say that our understanding of being humans is intrinsically connected to the fact that we believe ourselves to be autonomous agents.
Mm.
And so social psychology has taught us that, of course, we are under social influence many times.
Yeah.
Some of it is right. Sometimes it's rational to be under influence if the ones that you're being influenced by are more informed than you are.
Mm.
But if not, you just do collective pitfalls instead, right? That's where we have lemming effects and pluralistic ignorance and all those phenomena. Mm. Basically, where we unreflectively think that other people are more informed than we are, and then we march in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Realize one thing, by the way.
Yeah.
Social psychology is a very, very recent discipline to psychology, fairly recent.
Mm.
And the reason is that after the Second World War, a lot of researchers was puzzled by the fact that you could get an entire nation to subscribe to a catastrophic ideology. So how was that even possible?
Mm.
And social psychology came out of that, actually, because you wanted to understand why you could give everybody to subscribe to a catastrophic ideology, march the same way, have a certain outlook of the world. How was that even possible?
Mm-hmm.
So social psychology is actually after the Second World War.
Yeah, and also a new recent science, I would say, or field, is agnotology, the study of ignorance.
Right.
And there's a lot of that now with the internet.
Yeah.
And how important is it to actually cast light upon ignorance?
So that's a very good question.
Mm-hmm.
The way that philosophy has been looking at it through the millennia is, even have a term for it, is called epistemology. Episteme means knowledge, and logos means everything from theory to sign. But the theory of knowledge.
What is what?
Yeah, well, what is what? No, rather, how do we perceive what is?
Mm.
That's epistemology for you, right? The other thing that you were talking about is basically metaphysics or ontology, but we can maybe get that back to that.
The being, yeah.
Right. What characterizes what is, as Quine would say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we stick with epistemology for a second, much of epistemology is rooted in the idea that we are rational beings, and the reason why is the crown jewel of epistemology has always been knowledge,
mm-hmm.
is because we take it to be the best means for rational deliberation, decision, and action.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why we prize knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so through millennia, basically, philosophers have been occupied themselves with by providing a proper definition of what knowledge is. But we have always thought at the same time that the foe of epistemology is skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
And skepticism is a conglomerate of different points of view and entries to philosophy that goes to say, how is knowledge possible
mm-hmm.
if it's possible that we err or that we make mistakes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because we usually take knowledge to be infallible. Once you know something,
yeah.
then you're not going to be thrown off track. Whereas if you believe, you might actually have to revise your belief.
Mm-hmm.
But ever since Plato, the idea of the infallibility of knowledge has been pretty prevalent. Up until a paper was written by a very famous American philosopher, Harry Frankfurt,
mm-hmm.
wrote a paper in 86 or mid-80s, 85 maybe. It was called On Bullshit,
yeah.
which is a very vulgar
title. What a title.
It was a brilliant title.
Mm-hmm.
And where he goes, look, there's something even worse than skepticism,
mm-hmm.
okay? And there's something even worse than lying.
Certainty, maybe?
No, here it comes. He goes, well, at least the liar, he would say something or she would say something perpendicular to the truth,
mm-hmm.
but you would have to accept that there is a distinction between true and false. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you can't even define what a lie is.
True.
But there is something even worse than that. Mm-hmm. There is the person who does not and acknowledge that there is a distinction between true and falsity that you have to observe
mm-hmm.
or allude to.
Mm-hmm.
You can mix true with falsity all you want because mm-hmm. you are not, you're not in any way obligated to this particular definition, this particular distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he calls bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
So a bullshitter is one who mixes truth with falsity as you see fit
mm-hmm.
because you don't observe it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, my friend, is even worse than skepticism, or lying.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically that you allow you to be pretty ignorant
mm-hmm.
about a lot of things
mm-hmm.
because you don't have to observe this distinction. And he also asked why bullshit is such a salient feature these days, and this is pre the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, look, because there are many reasons to it, but there is an information overflow. So people have a lot of problems figuring out what is true and what is false. And so if there's so much work you have to do to figure it out, and you might even be able to figure it out, then you double back to your preconceived ideas, even if they're uninformed,
mm.
right? So that breeds ignorance.
Mm. Do you
So the study that you're alluding to
yeah.
is extremely important these
yeah.
days because the information flow is enormous.
Yeah. And my question for that is do you think that the three laws of logic might help as a toolkit for these bullshitters? Let's say the law of the excluded middle, the law of non-contradiction, and then we have the crown or the king, the law of identity.
Well, I have to tell you, if you're a real bullshitter, you couldn't care less about those things. They would say you don't even have to observe them.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, in a certain sense, you have to at least. It's going to be hard, for instance, to communicate anything
mm-hmm.
if there is no principle of non-contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So a precondition for any sort of reasonable conversation
mm-hmm.
is that you don't at least intentionally and in consequence just contradict yourself all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be like, Mo, are you, Vincent, listen, I'm sitting here doing this interview with you and I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing that in one and the same time in the same place. I would go, what are you talking
about?
That's
a contradiction. Yeah.
Right, that's a contradiction. and so unless you're willing to specify
mm-hmm.
while you are here and not at here at the same time, you are, as Aristotle would say, nothing but a plant.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so basically, if the bullshitter has an ambition of communicating anything,
mm.
then at least as a veil, you were going to need the principle of non-contradiction because otherwise I simply don't understand what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so our brain is probably wired in such a way that it doesn't understand contradictions very well,
mm-hmm.
Basically because it does not aid in deliberation, decision, and action.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we do all the time. So that's also what we're trying to understand.
And that's why we need more reasonable people like you. Because once the people of reason are ignored, more bullshitters are going
to
appear.
Okay, so here's a thesis for mm-hmm. you related to that. Now, look, there is you could try to insult people with a lot of different things. You could say
ad hominems,
right? And you could say, "Look, Vincent, you're a mulatto." I'm like, "Yeah, that's true. That's just the way the cards were dealt. I'm a pretty okay with that, and you can criticize me for it. Ain't nothing you can do about it anyway." So that would not really get to me. But if somebody came to me and said, "Listen, Vincent, you were just as you hit the every branch on the ignorance tree on the way down. You're just about as stupid as ever." And I basically, you know, I can insult your intelligence. That would go, wait. I mean, hang on a minute. At least give me an argument. And so you can try to insult people in a lot of different ways. But if you insult their intelligence, they tend to get really angry, right?
Mm.
And so for instance, in The Godfather, Michael Corleone says to Carlo Rizzi, after it becomes clear that Carlo had a hand in Sonny being killed, he goes, "Carlo, now you're insulting my intelligence, and it makes me very angry." And so I have this, it's been sort of the backbone of much of what I do is that if you start insulting people on their intelligence, they tend to get really angry.
Mm.
I'm writing on a new book called Sucker Nation, which sort of reversed that, where I go, well, maybe we are willing to be insulted on our intelligence when we trade wits for vanity. If you think there is something social capital in letting our wits go, then sometimes we are willing to sacrifice wits for vanity.
Yeah.
But up until, and that's really disconcerting more than anything. And you even have, you know, scams are based on insulting your intelligence. Right? I would go so far.
Nigerian prince, yeah.
Right. I mean, I would go so far as to say being on social platforms in many ways is designed to insult your intelligence. Why? Because to them, users are nothing but products. They are products of attention and they're products of data, and that's all you are. They couldn't care less about anything but that because that's part of their business model. And the more data that they have, the better profile they can have of you, the more surveilled you become. And if they can predict your behavior before you know it yourself, better still. And so basically, that's like having humans as products. And I got to tell you, if you talk about human as products, it's usually something with slavery, either that or prostitution somehow. And that would insult our intelligence. So I think in many ways we are systematically being insulted by our intelligence. And we really shouldn't, because it eats our autonomy away from us. And we are going to insist on both intelligence and autonomy. So why are we succumbing to being users where we sell out both just for a kick of social capital? That's at least the thesis.
No, it's an interesting thesis. And on that note, I want to ask about which unconscious cognitive patterns do these digital markets actually exploit then?
Okay, so that we actually know quite a bit. We know what makes us tick. So in 2013, a brilliant marketing professor from the Wharton Institute in Pennsylvania wrote a book, Contagious, What Ideas Catch On. And he analyzed 3,500 papers from the New York Times asking a simple question, namely, which of these news articles get a lot of traction, have a lot of viral life? And he ends up by analyzing them. He makes a taxonomy for it. And he goes, if you want to a story to go viral, it has to satisfy six criteria. And these six criteria are that there is some social capital in it for me if I send it on to you. It has to have some easy triggers. So when I say peanut butter, you say jelly. And so if I say that one of the most retweeted tweets ever was when Barack Obama won his second term. He came out with a very, very simple tweet where he's standing in an embrace with Michelle Obama. And the caption of the tweet is just four more years. So that's a great trigger because it basically says that on the pinnacle of power, love is intact.
Okay. Right?
Then it has to feed into our emotions. That's a very, very important part.
Negative emotions?
Both, both negative and positive emotions. So let me explain very briefly, because this might be of interest to the listeners. If you ask a psychologist about our emotions, they are made distinct on two axes. They could be positive, so happiness is positive. Anger is negative. That's one axis. Another axis is whether or not the particular emotion in question is what's called activity mobilizing or an activity demobilizing sentiment. Example, if I write out, on the social media, you know, I'm so happy today, then happiness is a positive emotion, you're for sure.
Yeah.
But it's not activity mobilizing, really, right? It's just it's a state in which I am in. Mm-hmm. It doesn't animate Mo to do anything. And if you do anything, good for you, Vincent. What does that have to do with me? Right. So it's a positive, but non-activity mobilizing sentiment. Mm-hmm. One. Two, if I write out, you know, all those foreigners and immigrants, right? They come into our country, they eat our donuts, they drink our coffee, and they eat our, and they also steal our lollipops or something. Yeah. Then watch it. See how much anger is negative. Uh-huh. But when I get angry, I want to do something, right? And so what I do online is I share, I click, I upvote, I whatever. And so because anger is a strong negative activity mobilizing emotion with a negative value, and so we have a lot of negative activity mobilizing sentiments: indignation, anger, fear. They tend to spread a lot online, and they spread wide and they spread deep, and that's because they're negative activity mobilizing sentiments. And so, the other three criteria is it has to have practical value. Mm-hmm. It has to have an easy storytelling. Mm-hmm. And then I forget the last one. Either way, out of those six criteria that Jonah Berger mentions, truth is neither a necessary or a sufficient condition. So you're going to have a viral story, which is not true, and a true story, which is not viral. And that is disconcerting, right? Mm-hmm. And so we know about how they're feeding into our emotions. And then there's another thing that is very prevalent, namely, what makes us humans do what's called repetitive actions? And there we have to go back to behavioral psychology, 1930s.
That's early.
But in the 1930s, an American behavioral psychologist at Harvard asked the following question: what makes an operant? And that could be a dove, or it could be a rat, but it could in principle also be a human, to do repetitive actions. What does it take? And then he sets up a little experiment that is so canonical, it's called a Skinner box. And a Skinner box is a shoe-size box with a lever in the end, by the end of the box. And whenever you pull the lever, the operant, let's say a rat, gets something to eat, right? So it pops out a feeding pill. He takes a hungry rat, he shoves it into the box, he watches what happens, and, the rat is zipping around the box, and all of a sudden it hits the lever, and it gets itself a feeding pill.
Yeah.
And all of it goes and adapts very quickly to this. It understands very fast that if I'm hungry, I just go pull the lever, and I get myself a pill. But that's not repetitive action, because unless the rat is hungry, he has no interest in the lever. Mm-hmm. So that's not repetitive action. Mm-hmm. Behavioral patterns. Mm-hmm. So what he does is that he modifies the experiment a little bit such that whenever you pull the lever, you wouldn't know whether you get 1, 0, or 2 feeding pills.
Okay.
So you don't know. So you could stomp on it 100 times, you don't get anything, and all of a sudden you get 2.
There's a level of unpredictability
in there. Right? And so it's called varying reward psychology.
Mm.
And if we don't know whether we are going to get a reward, we might continue a certain behavior until that is satisfied. Mm. That's how one-armed jacks also works, right?
Okay.
In a casino. Uh-huh. That's what casinos live on.
Yeah,
you don't know whether or not you'll get a reward, so you keep coming back.
Yeah.
And you come back, and in the end, we take it all, as Robert De Niro says in Casino.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that psychology is inherent on your iPhone now, because you don't know whether or not somebody liked your latest post, right? So you'll check it.
Yeah.
Or you don't know whether or not there's a new story on TikTok that you have to see, so you'll scroll.
Mm.
And so in the hope of a reward at some point.
Mm.
So a smartphone is also a one-armed jack, because it always keeps transmitting data back as long as you are in the reward psychology loop.
Mm.
And so basically, in the 90s, an American behavioral scientist at Stanford, his name was B.J. Fogg, did a course where Elon Musk was on it, Peter Thiel was on it, the one who started Lotus Notes was on it, where he figured, well, maybe I can automate this trigger process, right?
Mm-hmm.
In such a way you can get a computer to do the triggering for the reward, for the repetitive behavior. And that's what And all those guys took that course.
Uh-huh.
And you see the result today, basically most social platforms work like casinos.
Okay, that's very interesting because I remember when I made my it was
that's
at
what
high school.
So addictive.
Yeah, yeah, and on that note, because the correlation between anticipation and unpredictability. I remember making a report, the last report I needed to do in high school, where it was about gambling addiction. Mm-hmm. So I chose the two disciplines, psychology and biology.
Right.
And what was interesting is whenever it wasn't the winning that actually made the dopamine. It was the anticipation. So whenever the roulette was spinning, it was at that moment they made the scans. It was at the moment of anticipation right. before the result right. of whether you won or not.
Right.
That's where the dopamine release actually happened.
Absolutely.
And what's that correlation between anticipation and unpredictability with, let's say, the scrolling of social media?
It's the same thing, basically, right?
Same because mechanism.
It's the same mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So if the fact that I'm chasing social currency in my activities, as Jonah Berger would say, because I share, because I care, but also because but it doesn't have to be true. And care could also basically mean, Mo, that I can send this TikTok video on to you, you'll have a laugh, you'll send me back a like or whatnot. And so I'm sitting waiting for that one.
Mm-hmm.
Right, mm-hmm. And I scroll for I doom scroll until I find it. I might not even find it that day, so I have to go on the next day. But the problem is, of course, that if I don't find it the first day, I spend 11 hours trying to find a video for Mo. I haven't found it.
Mm.
So what am I going to do with those 11 hours? Sunk cost? Yes.
Uh-huh.
Unless, of course, I jump on it the next day and I find two. I can send on to Mo.
Mm.
That's like winning twice in the casino,
right?
But I'm hoping on the way that I'll find it. So my dopamine release is not necessarily, it could be when I find it, I get another hit, but just the anticipation of finding it is enough for me to keep going.
Wow.
And so basically, we are gamblers in a clandestine casino.
Wow. Yeah.
That's basically the best. And in the meantime, we'll still transmit a lot of data for them to use to profile us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a winning game for them no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a winning game for you because you might never find that video that I can send out, you can send on to me or I to you.
Mm. And on that, when it comes to attention,
yes.
Social media tries to get a hold of our attention,
right?
You talk about paying attention. That's the currency that we pay. What's the, if the attention economy, the relationship between attention economy and the digital medias, what's the primary mechanisms in which they try to get a hold of us?
Okay.
I've been studying this
for 20 years now or something like that. So back in 1971, I was 1 year old. Herbert Simon, who received the Nobel Prize in 1978 in economics for his studies of bounded rationality, among other things, he said something very prophetic back in 71, so 7 years before he got his Nobel Prize.
Way before the
internet. He said, in an information-rich world, the wealth of information means the dearth of something else. It will be the dearth of whatever it is, whatever information consumes.
Mm.
But what information consumes is pretty obvious. It consumes the attention of its recipients.
Mm.
And there you have it. He's the professor of psychology who coined the term in attention economics because he saw that there was a supply and demand situation between information and whatever information consumes, namely our attention.
Mm-hmm.
But we have never had so much information as we have now, but attention is still a scarce resource, right? There's only 24 hours in a day. I still have to, you know, take down the trash, make love to my wife, whatnot, go to work. So there's only that much time in which I can pay my attention and see, right? It's an expense for me. I'm paying with it in the hope of a return.
Mm-hmm.
And the return will be whatever information it is that I consume.
Mm.
But if the amount of information is forever rising and attention is still a fixed resource or a finite resource, then there will be a very competitive market for capturing our attention.
Mm.
And that's the game that the social platforms is in.
Mm.
Because the more attention that they grab, the more data we deliver, the more they can analyze, and then they can, in the end, send it as advertising to the advertisers or as marketing products or campaigns, or they can predict behavior before we know it.
Yeah.
Right. And so they are in the business of grabbing our attention. And we take attention to be a cognitive resource. Back in 1889, William James, professor of philosophy at Columbia University, wrote a book called The Principles of Ecology, in which he says, the reason why attention is so important to us humans is because it's a gateway to our consciousness.
Consciousness, yeah.
Right? If I can't get through the gateway, and now we are sitting here, you and me, looking each other in the eyes. So we are paying attention to each other.
Yeah.
If I can't, if you're not giving, paying me attention, I can't get into your head,
yeah,
nor can you get into mine.
Mm.
But in a second, somebody, I'm going to drop this on the floor.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, all the attention goes down here. So there's nothing for Mo, and everything goes to picking up my phone.
Yeah.
So it's a zero-sum game when I use it. I can't use it more than once. And if I do it on one thing, I can't do it on the other. I can't put attention in a bank and get interest on it.
Mm-hmm.
So once I burn it, I burn it. So it's a very elusive asset.
Yeah.
So you got to make sure that people keep paying it.
Mm.
And how do you do that? Varying reward psychology.
Mm, right?
So that's basically the business model.
Okay. And essentially, if there is an equivalent exchange,
right,
if I need to pay attention to you and you need to pay attention to me,
yeah,
that makes me almost want to go to the meme section because it's very related.
You're the boss.
But before that, my prediction is going to be that essentially we're going to end up at a place where everything is going to be mental anarchy. So once I scroll, I have my phone, I'm going to look, Trump, I'm going to be like, fuck that. I scroll. Right. I'm going to see Kim Kardashian, I'm going to be like, fuck that. And then just scroll. Because then I'm like, okay, they're all trying to grab my attention and everyone's trying to compete for my attention.
Right.
And it's such a scarce asset of mine that now I'm either I disconnect from everything,
right,
when it comes to social media, or I'm just going to be an anarchist in that sense.
Or you understand what we just talked about, and you realize that the greatest asset that you have is your attention.
Yeah.
So you got to be damn careful what you pay it to.
Yeah.
Because without it, you are a plant.
Yeah.
Nothing but a plant. You see what I'm saying? And so the reason why I'm saying that is because going back to us being insulted systematically, we are being robbed of the most valuable resource that we have, and they're not even paying for it. They're just taking it.
We are the ones paying.
We are the product here. Yeah. And I don't think that's not going to be the destiny of humanity, right? And that scares me more than anything.
Yeah, yeah. On the section of memes, I'm going to show you three memes.
Yes, sir.
This is the first one with Will Smith, Bel Air.
I was going to put it on notice that I noticed you too. Is that it?
Yeah. I want to put you on notice that I notice you too.
Right.
So it's when we talk about attention and noticing each other, this collective consciousness that okay, I'm going to make you notice that I notice that you notice.
That's common knowledge.
Mm.
I mean, basically, that's a comment on common knowledge.
Uh-huh.
So what is common knowledge? Common knowledge is a very, 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 very important feature for us humans because it's a precondition for coordination.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that we drive on the right side of the road in Denmark.
Denmark,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. I know that too.
Mm.
But suppose we come driving opposite each other.
Yeah.
And I know that we drive on the right side, and you know it.
Uh-huh.
We have to coordinate of not crashing into each other.
Mm.
But that's the fact that I know that we can drive on the right side, and you know it, we know it respectively, doesn't entail that we couldn't drive into each other. Because if I don't know that you also know that we drive on the right side of the road, I could start swirling over in your direction not to hit you, because I don't know whether or not you know that we drive on the right side.
Mm.
So it's not enough for me to know that, for us to coordinate in traffic, it's not enough for me to know that we drive on the right side of the road. You have to know it too. But I have to know that you know it, and you have to know that I know it,
yeah,
and I have to know that you know that I know that you know that. That's common knowledge.
Uh-huh.
And that it's the precondition for coordination.
But
and more importantly than that, when we have demonstration down on City Hall Square,
yeah,
the politicians know that this is a demonstration.
Mm.
It's because if they didn't know, they wouldn't care.
Mm.
The demonstrators know that they know that it's a demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
They know that they know that I know that they know, back and forth. The dissent and assent is based on it. So our democracy and public space, what we take public space to be, is a place where we can establish common knowledge. Mm. The problem with the social media, the way we converse there, is it doesn't guarantee that we have a lot of information, but it doesn't entail that the level of common knowledge has arisen accordingly. Mm. So we can misunderstand each other's jokes. Mm-hmm. What you take to be a joke, I take seriously because I can't know that you take it as a... I don't know that you take it as a joke.
Yeah.
And you don't know that I will necessarily understand it as a joke, although you meant it as a joke. And so we are barred from having common knowledge. So a lot of the misunderstandings and misconceptions online is based on the fact that we may have knowledge, but we don't have common knowledge. It makes a hell of a difference.
Mm. I mean, I remember watching or seeing a bio on Facebook where it said common sense, common ground, common knowledge.
Yeah. That doesn't follow.
It doesn't follow?
Common sense, common ground. Well, common ground is closer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have common ground about driving on the right side.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't have common ground, then we have common ground.
Uh-huh.
We might not be able to coordinate.
Uh-huh. And what's the relation between common knowledge and epistemic trust, let's say?
Okay, so that's a huge discussion in philosophy also now and in game theory and other places.
Mm. Game theory is very interesting, yeah.
We might get back to that if we have time.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is basically that if you want to have epistemic trust in your peers, then they would have to know the same as you do, possibly more. But right? So a big part of epistemic trust is reliant on common knowledge.
Mm, mm. Taking us to the next meme.
Yes, sir.
Go on.
It is what it is. Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
It is and what is and isness itself.
Was that what he said?
No, he said it is what it is.
It is.
I actually remember I made my first TikTok video in 2020, Corona, where...
Shame on you, Mo.
That was where the first time I participated. And I used that meme in the context of we just had math exams. And then my friends asked me, what did you get as a grade? And I just said, it is what it is.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. Yeah. Why is that so significant?
Well, it's a tautology. A tautology means saying the same thing twice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a statement that is always true, right? It's never false, but it's not necessarily very informative, right? A equals A. I agree, but doesn't mean it is what it is. Doesn't make it very informative. And so tautologies are statements that are always true, but not necessarily too informative. Another would be either it rains or it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's true when it rains, but it's also true when it doesn't. So either way, it's true, but it doesn't provide much information, right? Mm. I'm covering all possible grounds. And so the way in which we get informed is not by tautologies, because they are always true, but by what's called contingent statements, statements that are sometimes true and sometimes false, depending on the circumstances. But it doesn't mean necessarily that these tautologies, they could be well-placed ever so often, right?
Mm-hmm.
They might have a rhetorical, they could add rhetorical finesse. And one of my favorites is, for instance, and Robert De Niro is known for saying this in a lot of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, in The Deer Hunter, he says it to Stanley, who is this goofball of a friend he has, and he's always forgotten something. They got to go hunting. He forgot his boots. He's always forgetting something. He's a mess. John Casale plays his role, by the way, magnificently.
Mm.
Anyway, and so he takes up a bullet from his rifle, and he goes, Stanley, look at this. Look at this. This is this. This ain't something else. This is this. In other words, get your shit in order.
Mm. Right?
So it might have an implicature meaning, which is important.
Mm.
In Heat, he says it again to Al Pacino, where they're having a discussion, they're meeting at a diner, and they're having a discussion about their work, and they're actually, one is a robber, or the other one is a police officer, but their lives are pretty alike.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, Al Pacino says something to the extent of, isn't your life pretty vague? Because he has to walk away from everything he loves whenever he feels the heat around the corner.
That's a big existential question.
Basically. And then Al Pacino, Robert De Niro goes, well, you know, it is what it is.
Mm.
And so sometimes even the obvious can have an implicature of a meaning that's important.
Mm.
So that's the reason why tautologies also might actually sometimes be nice.
I would argue even that it's as you said, it's always true.
Right.
And when it when it's always true, that means that in all circumstances,
it's never false.
It's never false. Right. But that's the significance actually of that law, the law of identity, because even the three laws, we can reduce it to the first law.
Right.
And some would even say that their Godhead is the first law of logic, that their God is that which always is, the necessary, right. As opposed to the contingent, what can be and what is.
Right. Yeah, you can say that. I mean, assuming, of course, that you fix language in a very close relation to metaphysics. And that's difficult. That's also pretty difficult, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, usually we take language to be a representation of our understanding of reality.
How we use it. Wittgenstein.
Yeah, in a certain sense, Wittgensteinian point of view, right? We use language to describe the world. But sometimes we also use language to act in the world, right? So in a baptizing, for instance, if I don't say I baptize you X, Y, and Z, I'm not really doing it unless I say it. Mm-hmm. The same goes for an apology. I don't give you an apology unless I say I apologize to you. And so we also use action language for action. But a lot of philosophy is sort of based on the idea that language, natural language, is some sort of mirror of reality to a certain extent. But a lot of what reality does or is escapes language, right? We can't even actually describe it. And we might even be able to describe it consistently if our language is inconsistent somehow. So that's the reason why we refer, and that's why we retort to, say, formal languages. Mathematics, for instance, is a language, which is much more rigid than formal than natural language.
Yeah.
And so we can at least get the skeleton, but we might not get all the details. But the reason why we keep pushing forward is our unbiased sort of curiosity for what the world is like, and we use whatever means available to that end. And language is one, and mathematics another, and physics is the third, and biology is the fourth, and the same goes with the humanities and the social science.
Interesting.
Basically, the way I look at science is that science is basically a systematic way of uncovering robust structure, whether it's molecule structures or social institutions, it doesn't matter. And it's what's robust about a lot of different phenomena and what do they share in a robust skeleton.
And to what extent do you then think that the human experience actually corresponds with reality? Are we having a real encounter with reality now, or is it all constructed in the
question.
Imagination?
Well, I don't think that we have gotten any closer to that answer than Plato and then Aristotle, really. That is basically, or even before them, actually, come to think of it. But the human experience is, as Kant would say, our experience of reality is always filtered through our senses and the way we organize our experience, right? So we don't get to see the world as it is in itself.
As it is.
And sich. It's always für uns. That means for us. And there is a disconnect between the way I perceive the world and what the world is in and by itself. And so what we do with science is we try to get closer and closer approximations as to what the world is in itself. But it's always based on human modeling. So, for instance, a good example is the periodic table, right, where we have all the ground elements. Now, of course, nature doesn't, or you know, it's not like nature had the periodic table hanging around and then said, okay, I'm going to do Mo now, and then I'm going to do a molecule structure over here. I'm going to take three zincs and then stick that on. It doesn't work like that, right? So the periodic table is a model of the elements of nature. But nature is not a mapping like that, right? It is what it is.
Yeah.
It's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
But so the periodic table is a good approximation. And so what we do in science and what we do in philosophy is we try to make good models of reality. And sometimes are more robust than others. Some theories are more robust than others. And that's what science is. Science is basically the conglomeration of the most robust theories about reality.
That's very interesting. You used the periodic table as an example. I've heard that the one who actually came up with it, I remember he was Russian, right? A Russian scientist, that he actually got the idea from his dream. Now, I haven't verified that statement, but it's as if his imagination through that, you know, his dream where he just had that model laid out,
right.
is interesting to that question.
But that doesn't make it, it doesn't make it like he had an epiphany, right? I mean, he might have had it in a dream.
Yeah.
Some of the best thoughts I ever have are some of the times.
In the shower?
When I solve proofs,
yeah.
Right? Is right before I wake up.
Mm.
My brain, so the way I usually do stuff is like this. So when I write books, for instance, I write a chapter and then I prepare the next chapter. Then I read a little bit about what I want to do, put in the next chapter. And then that's about it. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I had enough. Okay, let me go run my radio controlled car, go to the movies, whatever.
Yeah.
Hang out with my wife or my son. At least not thinking about this problem.
Mm.
But it doesn't mean that the brain doesn't process it. Mm. It does. I'm just doing other things in the meantime.
Mm.
And so my subconscious is just grinding away on this problem while I pay attention to something else.
Mm.
And then sometimes in the morning, usually I get this readout at like 5 o'clock and my brain goes, I'm ready with the answer now.
And just
then
comes
I basically
out.
Write a chapter in 6 hours. That's it. And I don't even think much about it. It's just there.
Mm.
It just needs to get out.
Mm.
And so the same thing about your Russian scientist in the periodic table.
Mm.
His subconsciousness is grinding away on the problem in a regimented way.
Mm.
And at some point he goes, here we go, here it is. And of course, not all the details are in place and we can wiggle around with it. But, you know, the nuts and bolts are pretty much in order.
Mm. The last section or the segment is going to be about bubbles. And I have, you've actually written a book called, it's about the main character syndrome, right?
Oh, the latest book, yes.
Yeah, Enough About Me?
No, well, that's the one before that. The one you're referring to is What About Meism?
Mm.
Insight from Game Theory, Behavioral Economics, and Moral Philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And that book... It's not really about bubbles, but it's about, suppose you consider life to be one big zero-sum game.
Mm.
So whatever Mo gets is something that I get depleted of,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you get a new girlfriend, then I don't get.
Mm.
If you get a new job, I don't get it. So what would life look like if everything was a zero-sum game?
Mm.
And the entire backbone of the story was that it's sort of been a saying in my family where you could say, well, what about me? And when I was 12 years old, I got a radio-controlled car from my brother, Lamborghini Countach.
Oh, that's a nice gift.
Yeah, but it was not one of those things you can buy down in the toy store. It was from my hobby store. It was really expensive. My grandmother came with it from the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And I had a birthday party, and my friends came over, and they wanted to try the car. And all of a sudden, I realized that if they had to try the car, I wouldn't be able to try my own car on my own birthday. So I went to my father, and I go, well, what about me? And my father go, well, what about you? This is not about you. It's about them.
Mm.
Why don't you just enjoy the fact that they get to play with your car without you somehow thinking that it's on you, you know, this is something that is being robbed from you.
Mm.
Those are two different things.
Mm.
And so it became sort of a thing in this family where you could go, well, what about me? And the family would go, well, what about you?
Mm.
And right. So it's about the way in which we sometimes take life to be a zero-sum game.
Mm.
Whatever somebody else will get is somehow something that got robbed from me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how would the world look like? And it turns out in the end, after a lot of game theoretical analysis and whatnot, that it's a highly irrational way of thinking about life,
mm-hmm.
because you could actually have received more had you decided to cooperate than not doing it.
Mm-hmm. And do these two correlate? That means that the bubbles and us thinking that us living in our bubbles and us.
Yeah, my understanding of bubbles is somewhat different because my understanding of bubbles stems from economics.
Mm-hmm.
So when you overvalue an asset beyond what its fundamental value is, mm-hmm. that could be stock, but it could also be real estate, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Now just apply the bubble theories, if you wish, to an information market ruled by an attention economy,
mm-hmm.
as we talked about a while back.
Mm-hmm.
There you can build attention bubbles,
mm.
where a lot of attention is being paid to a person or a cause or a case or an incident,
mm.
but the truth can't follow,
mm.
all right?
Mm.
But you'll still, so to speak, you still, so to speak, allocate a lot of attention to story which are not either significant or not true. And so there is the inspiration to the Center for Information and Bubble Studies, mm-hmm. because there's only this much bandwidth in public space. Mm. So if you get people to worry about this over here, they're not going to worry about this over here. Mm. And so Steve Bannon, who used to be the old advisor of Donald Trump and one of the big MAGA roots, was asked in 2019, who's the real enemy? And since he's MAGA, people would think he would say the Republicans. But he didn't say that. What he said was, well, our enemy is the established media. Mm. And the way we handle you people is that we flood the zone with shit.
Okay.
So what he really, and that has been a very consistent way of ruling, because you know there's only this much bandwidth, right? So if you throw out 15, 20 stories, some of them true, some of them non-true, and the media starts running over here looking at this story, then in the meantime, you can move over there because attention can't be paid twice, right? Mm. So it works on the media, but it also works on the judicial system, right? Because a lot of the stuff that's been going on with the President Trump's executive orders is probably not legal, at least should be tried one case at a time. But, there are almost 200 of those executive orders, so the judicial system is going to fold under its own weight. Mm-hmm. Right? So it works on the judicial system, too. Mm-hmm. It works on the media. Mm-hmm. It works on the financial markets, too. Remember when he came out with his cardboards of tariffs? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was 20% was shaved off the entire stock market on a single day, right? Uh-huh. So you can shock the market, uh-huh. But you can also shock the political system. Uh-huh. Now, you can flooding the zone with shit is also, so it's very efficient in liberal democracies when it comes to the press, uh-huh. when it comes to the financial market, when it comes to the judicial system, and it comes to real clear politics. In other words, four pillars of liberal democracy has a very hard time if you flood the zone with shit, because you pay attention to certain bubbles over here, but not to others over there, which might be more important. Mm.
So flooding the zone with shit, because when I think of bubbles, even philosophically speaking, I'm thinking of something that has maybe not an inherent essence or something that's at least inflated in a sense.
Right.
So a bubble is something that can be popped very easily, and it doesn't really have any substance, or at least its reality is not as what appears.
Yeah. And it works a little bit differently on an information market ruled by an attention economy, because sure, some of them are pop, but most of them are just deflated. Mm. And the way that means people are paying attention to something else, right? Mm. And so if you look at Twitter storms, they usually peak and then they drop because people have been spending attention on something else. Mm. And then sometimes you'll see a blurb again here and there if new information comes into the chamber. But usually people just pay attention elsewhere. So they seldomly pop. What they usually do is they slowly deflate, or sometimes fast deflate.
Mm. Okay, that takes us to the last meme, actually, about bubbles.
Woman, I don't know where the fuck you live.
No.
Yeah. Is that a symptom of main character syndrome, maybe? Living in your own bubble?
Well, so main character syndrome is a theme I take up in the last book. And a main character syndrome is a situation where people act as if they create their own metaphysics, right? So they create their own world.
Mm.
And everybody in that world, whether they're taxi drivers or lovers or teachers or whatnot, are basically roles that others are being asked to play by you. Uh-huh. To fit your manuscript.
Support roles,
They're always, everybody else supporting roles, or they're basically props.
Mm.
And the problem with that point of view is, of course, you can write your own ontology all you want, but you can't make sure that the world is going to go along with it.
Mm.
I mean, Putin might have a main character syndrome as if being a czar, but as you see, the world is not really in on it.
Uh-huh.
And so main character syndrome became very hot on TikTok back in 21, 22, where it became sort of a criticism of users making videos as if they were the main character in their own movie and everybody else was either supporting roles or just props.
Yeah.
And you are, I mean, you're going to get disappointed in life if you walk along as if you can entertain a main character syndrome, mm-hmm. because the world is going to resist you having a, the world's not going to be able to cash in your expectations, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. you can't write the manuscript of the world.
No.
And so from that perspective, a main character syndrome is pretty dangerous for us people to entertain.
Mm. Are there then any metacognition practices we can make to actually negotiate with our own bubbles?
Okay, so here's the thing. I mean, look, we are constantly, as I write in the latest book, pendulizing between megalomania and inferiority complexes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we think we are the most important thing in the world, at least according to ourselves, and sometimes we feel as if we ain't worth shit. Mm. And we have to balance in between the two. And so, for instance, one of the examples I have in the book is when I was a teenager, I was in love with this girl at school, and she didn't want me, and I had a lot of pain coming my way because of it. And I went to my pop, who's a physicist, and I went, "Dad, look, this woman that I'm heavily in love with, she doesn't want me." And my father said, "Listen, son, compared to the size of the universe, our problems are pretty small." And I was like, that's it for me? that's the answer? But in a certain sense, after I reflected upon it a little bit, it was sort of right. Yeah. Mm. Of course, it filled out my world, but it didn't fill out the world. Mm. And so we should stop thinking that whenever something happens to us, good or bad or neutral, that is somehow an indication of the way of the world. Mm. No, it's the way of your world, but you're in it along with somebody, a lot of other people. Mm. So if you think you're the only one, then chances are you're going to get megalomania, and the world is going to resist it, okay? It also means that you might get inferiority complex, and I think all of us do, more or less. It's also part of the survival instinct that we also don't sometimes feel that we're worth anything. Mm. And so what we should do is, as I write in the end of the book, is that there are certain things we can't, speaking of metaphysics, there is just something we can't think away and we will still be humans. Mm. We are full of water, we sense, and we are thinking beings. We are individuals, we are social beings, we don't want to get insulted in our intelligence, and we want to take responsibility for ourselves and others. If we are letting those go, then it's going to be hard to think of us as being humans, right? That's what is the bare necessities. Mm. What we seem that is necessary is a different story. Mm. So, for instance, a poll came out last year where 37% of the Americans think they couldn't survive as humans
without their phone.
Without their phone. Mm. Now, that's what seems to be necessary, but it's not necessary to be human, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not making the distinction what seems necessary and what is necessary. Mm. And that's a very important distinction to uphold.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, this is our last remarks. I mean, this is very humbling when you say that we need to actually negotiate with our bubbles, and we are in the primary, like the world is bigger than us. The world is bigger,
but at the same time, we don't want to get insulted in our intelligence. Mm-hmm. I think, yes, the world is bigger than we are, obviously. So take that into account when you configure your life. And also take into configuration of your life that you don't want, at least intentionally, to be insulted on your intelligence. And then that's a good way to start.
What's the solution? Is it being ironic about the whole thing? Maybe this, no, like Socrates.
You can be ironic without being cynical. Mm. So that's the difference. Mm. Right? So you can be ironic. You can crack a joke about life and yourself ever so often. Mm. It might actually be good. Mm. But that doesn't mean that you have to be cynical about it, right?
How significant is Socrates' statement in this context?
Which one of them?
The only thing I know
is that I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that's epistemic humility, right? You're being epistemically humble, and that's a good thing. Don't presume yet yourself that you're all-knowing, because then you got yourself a main character syndrome. Mm. I think I'm not a religious person, but the only one who could legitimate having a main character syndrome is the guy upstairs, right? But none of us are.
He's the center of the show, that's it. Thank you very much. It's been a very insightful episode, and I'm very glad to have you even on this pilot episode. So you have our thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.